are friends with fantasy benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
Anybody who, you are venerable, and the guy who's vulnerable instead of venerable is our good friend, Evan Peterson.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Do not come to me for any fantasy hockey talk, because I will have nothing for you. But that's all, 7 years of fantasy hockey, wow.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Everything that you look for in why his numbers should be great are all there, except for the numbers themselves.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits. It's you, baby, yeah.
This is a special podcast. Our friend Ben Brennis is off vacationing, enjoying his lovely girlfriend, and we even managed to not have him to have to chime in or do anything to get this whole thing to work. So there's something to be said for that. And that is partially because of our friend Andrew Dewhurst, who is with us. And Andrew, why don't you let everyone know how you're doing, what your Twitter handle is, and what you're working on these days.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. I'm writing typically bi-weekly on the Friends with Fantasy Benefits website. Actually, I'm doing weekly right now, and you can look forward to some hockey content coming in the next few weeks.
Yeah, you are the hockey guru of us as well, are you not? How long have you been playing fantasy hockey?
Probably about 7 years.
Oh, well, that's like I said, you are venerable. Anybody who, you are venerable, and the guy who's vulnerable instead of venerable is our good friend, Evan Peterson. How are you doing, Evan?
I'm doing phenomenal. Do not come to me for any fantasy hockey talk, because I will have nothing for you. But that's all, 7 years of fantasy hockey. Wow. That's, wow.
That's wow, Evan says. You are Easy Ev 3, right?
Yeah, that's where you can find me on the Twitter machine, or just find me doing these podcasts, doing a little bit of writing with the football season around the corner. I'm probably going to get my production up a little bit, so we'll see what happens. But we're ready to talk baseball. I haven't sat down with you in a couple weeks, Chuck.
That's true. Our fortunes did not cross. Our paths did not cross before this for the last couple weeks. But I'm excited to be with you guys, and I came up with a topic and let you guys come up with some names. And what we did is we all went through our memory banks and through the people that maybe we haven't touched on a whole lot recently, and decided on three players each that we think are especially hard to gauge going forward. And we all took this a little bit differently. So some of them may be some people who are recovering from injuries or some injury risks, and some of them are people that are playing really well. We're just trying to figure out exactly where we place them going forward for both the rest of this year and for next year as far as trade options, dynasty leagues, etc. We're going to start with Mr. Dewhurst, and he's got some very interesting people for us. Who's the first person you want to touch on that we're trying to gauge going forward here?
Yeah, the first guy I want to touch on was Aaron Nola, starting pitcher for the Phillies. He's been absolutely on fire lately, but the sample size is what makes him difficult to judge. He's hasn't given up more than two earned runs since June 16th. But he's giving up home runs. He's given up home runs in four of those six starts. And as a home run to fly ball rate, sitting at 12.5.
Yeah, he's had a pretty interesting season, and I have noticed that he's been on fire lately. Evan, what are your thoughts about Aaron Nola going forward?
Well, I've been pretty pro Nola, as we've kind of talked on this podcast. You want to talk about his last seven starts where he's gone six innings plus in all of them. In his previous eight starts this year, he only hit that mark four times, so he's going longer into games. If you want to talk about his batting average against, he's seen major decreases from May to June to July, even though his BABIP fluctuation hasn't been drastic at all. It's been really steady. Go check out those numbers. They're kind of cool. And it's you hit my first bit of trivia on the first guy. So we gotta throw this up here. Aaron Nola has the 10th lowest batting average through the first two times of the lineup at just under 200. So the interesting bit of trivia is the guy at the top, and we'll work our way up. So the guys in front of him are Chris Archer, Zach Greinke, Ray, Lynn, Wood, Kershaw, Scherzer, Sale, and who is the top guy at batting average against first two times through the lineup? You get one guess apiece. AL, I'll give you that much.
I'm going to guess Marcus Stroman.
Wow. That's not a guess that I was about to come up with. I'm trying to think of guys that have really started out games very solid and then haven't. And since one of my guys let me down on the mound already tonight, I'm going to say Jason Hamill.
I mean, you were more towards the side of the player pool that we're going for. Brad Peacock at 244 batter sample was what I was looking at. Either way, we can point and laugh at Peacock. We can point and say, hey, Nola's been pretty good at looking at that group of guys that he's kind of lumped with there. I really like Nola, and I think this is something that you can buy going forward, and you're just going to have to roll the dice on the injury stuff.
Yeah, well, my take on Aaron Nola is, first of all, he's just 24 years old. He's been around for a couple years now, so maybe not everyone realized that he was that young. He's got 9.35 Ks per nine this year with 2.8 walks per nine. His walks are actually up a little bit. If you wanted to play negative, and I'm really not going to be negative on him, but if you wanted to play negative, he's got a really high strand rate this year, 78.6%. And that seems especially high when you consider that his ground ball percentage is down 7%, so you'd think that would hurt the strand rate. And his hard contact rate is up 2.7%. So that's why his FIP is a little bit higher than his ERA. But I believe, memory serves me correctly, he's at a 3.38 ERA, so he's doing really well. The other thing I want to note about Nola is, as far as trading for him for the rest of this year, just remember that he may be looking at an innings cap with the fact that the Phillies aren't really playing for anything. And he had a career-high 111 innings pitched in 2016. So if you're going to own him in a dynasty or if you're trading for next year, what you really want him to do is sort of get up to that 150, 160 inning mark this year. So next year there would be no restrictions. But I agree that Aaron Nola is a guy I didn't know exactly how to take going into this year because he was really good, and then he got hurt, and then he was mediocre. But this year, he was pretty good, and lately, he's been really, really good. So there's definitely something to say for Aaron Nola as being a guy who could creep in, what do we think, the top 25 starting pitchers next year if he were to finish strong this year? You think that's fair, Andrew?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I would also be a little bit weary of that innings cap, because if he's not going to hit 200, it's hard to see him get that creep into that top 25 for me, at least.
Well, I mean, there is the trouble with him being a Philly as well. You think top 30 is more likely there, Evan?
I mean, I think you're kind of in the range. If you're talking about maybe where he finishes overall, some people will bake in the injury risk and push him a little bit further down the list, but I would probably draft him, what, like a top 150 guy next year overall?
Yeah, that seems pretty fair because he'll have a decent amount of upside. I guess the Nick Williams call up in Philadelphia helps their offense a little bit, and Mikel Franco bouncing back a little bit in the second half, as well as Odubel, might help as well. Well, Evan, why don't we go on to your first guy? Who's the first guy that you came up with to be a tough one to pinpoint where they're going to be the rest of the way and next year?
Yeah, he's really puzzling, and I understand the allure of this guy, A, because he's been crushing ass, and B, because he plays absolutely everywhere. But Marwin Gonzalez, this power surge that came out of everywhere – out of nowhere. Like, he was homering once every 44 plate appearances prior to this season. He's homering every 16 plate appearances this season. If you look at the list of pitchers he's hitting them off of, like, he hit one off Kluber, one off Verlander, and the rest are kind of meh. but they still count, even though the home run to fly ball rate is stupid, ridiculous, and very unsustainable. And the only other thing is the walks, which he had over 888 plate appearances the past two seasons, took 38 walks. He's got 31 and 294 plate appearances this year. So I don't know if people are respecting this power surge that they're seeing from him or what exactly is going on. But I'm kind of curious at what you guys think about Marwin, because he was up to, I want to say, like 80% ownership in Yahoo last time I checked.
Well, I will. I'll start this one because I can add to some things that you said. Marwin Gonzalez is 28 years old. He really sort of he took a step up last year, but nothing like the leap forward that he's taking this year. I looked up his games played because I was curious about, you know, conceivably next year's eligibility. He's got 20 games at first base, so he's set there in most leagues next year. He's got 9 games at second base, which you'd think maybe he would get another game there at some point. If he's got 9 to this point, maybe he gives Altuve a break at some point. He's got 17 games at third base, which Bregman has scuffled along, hit a home run today. But there's a pretty decent chance that he'll get third base eligibility. And he's got 11 games at shortstop, which I find really interesting, because 11 games at shortstop, of course, Correa is going to be out for a while here. So if he were to creep up to 20 games at shortstop, I think that makes a big difference. And he's got 31 games between the three outfield spots. So that's 5 different positions. I mean, 7 if you count all three outfield positions that he's played. 7 different positions that he's played at a semi-regular pace so far this year. I think a lot of his value for next year hangs in that shortstop balance, because the replacement level at shortstop is so much lower than it is at most of the other places around the diamond, except for catcher. You know, his walk rate basically doubled between last year, which, you know, I'm just going to put it in a different form than what Evan did. He was a 4.2% walk rate guy last year, and he's at 10.5% this year. So I'm always the guy, and Evan hates to hear this, but I'm always the guy who likes the multi-position eligibility, partially because I play in some of those draft and hold leagues where we can't pick up players and you have to try and keep your rosters full for the entire season after the draft. And Marwin Gonzalez is definitely a guy who's got serious possibilities for that, even though when you look at the BABIP way up over 340, you've got to think that there's some pretty serious regression. But if you got between 2016 and 2017, I don't think anyone's going to be so hot on Marwin Gonzalez that he's going to cost so much that he's not a draft possibility. But I do realize that Andrew is not as high on Marwin Gonzalez as I am. So why don't you dash my hopes there, Andrew?
Yeah, like you, I play in a lot of daily transaction leagues and head-to-head leagues. So I love the multi-position eligibility, because those extra at-bats and will win you weeks. The problem with Marwin Gonzalez is that when you look at his difference in stats from last year to this year, or the last 3 years to this year, even in reasonable number of bats, or like we're talking 518 at bats in 2016, where he hit 254 and he's up to 320, like almost every statistical category is up more than 100 percentage points. It might be okay for this year. Still getting lots of at-bats, especially with the Correa injury. Moving forward, though, these are the types of guys that are usually the bane of my existence, because I head for the hills on these guys. Unless I'm able to get them extremely late in drafts, I'm not willing to chance it.
The one thing, just because you mentioned kind of his last 2 years, was that he fixed a big problem with his swinging strike rate due to his work on pitches outside the zone. So right now he's swinging at a career low, 28.3% of pitches outside, which is about 5 percentage points off his career average. Contact against pitches outside the zone is over 70%. After he was under 63% the previous 2 years. So we're seeing kind of a shift in his batting eye, and he's kind of been a guy that's like stuck around and got playing time, and now he's just seeing more of it because the Astros have kind of had to work some things out where, you know, their first base situation didn't work out the way they wanted. Correa's down. Bregman kind of stunk for a second. Like, he's gotten the time, and I think if he just gets run, I think, like Chuck said, the shortstop eligibility is going to float him a long way.
Well, you know, I do think we're pointing at some interesting things here about Marwin. Number one is we're hinting that the format is very specific. But I would also go so far as to say that the kind of draft that you're in will make a difference. Like, I'm a guy who is in a lot of grassroots drafts, is what I basically call them, you know, where the guys are getting together to drink beer all day and draft, and half the guys have a magazine that they bought at the store a week before. And with Marwin Gonzalez not having a distinct role in and of itself, that could lend to the hopes that Andrew and I have that a guy like this would slide really far down the draft. And when that happens, when you're throwing darts at a board anyway, it can be of a significant boost to you to have a guy that could help your roster in a number of different areas. Then even in a traditional league, you don't have to have as many bench players if he's playing decent enough for him to fill in at two, three, or four different positions. So Marwin Gonzalez is definitely an interesting guy, and I was really happy that Evan brought him to our attention, because he's having a phenomenal year, but you don't really know how to take the power, because everybody's got that kind of power right now. And then you add in the fact that the ball might change again next year. So we're not exactly sold on him, but he's somebody that I think we're in agreement that you need to keep an eye on. And in certain spots, you can take a late gamble on and see exactly how it all plays out. My first guy is an interesting guy because he came into the league with the nickname the Messiah. He's 29 years old now. He was a legendary prospect. I mean, his first start was played on ESPN Live. He is, of course, Steven Strasburg. His 3.15 FIP is the second highest ever that he's had. But I want you to think about this. His 3.15 FIP is the second highest ever. And one time he had a 3.21 FIP. That was back in 2013. Now, me and Andrew are both going to hint to this in different ways, I believe. But outside of the 2013 and 2014 window, he's averaged a mere 145 innings pitched. But he has a career 10.54 strikeouts per nine. And the question I'm going to ask, along with the analysis, is all this anarchy in the middle tier, it seemed like a lot of people shied away from Strasburg going into this year because he was an injury risk. Well, now, of course, we find out that Dusty Baker is denying that it's serious. But after I brought up the name, he goes out in a start and he leaves the start with forearm issues. And so even though they're claiming it's not serious, and maybe the Nats don't really need him to make the playoffs at this point, it kind of is something we were gonna mix in to his value to begin with, the fact that he hasn't been very durable. But again, I want to know if, you know, you take all this stuff that's happened, you know, the Justin Verlanders who have been up and down, and, you know, the Carlos Carrasco, the hurt guys, the Danny Salazars, the people that moved to SunTrust like Kieran. I mean, these guys are all not what we hoped they were going to be. So in a way, that could kind of, if there's a lot of uncertainty around all these guys, it's a little more reassuring to go with the guy who's got a 10.5 K per nine for his career and a guy who's usually pretty dominant when he's on the mound. So what do you think, Evan? Are you going to be less averse to Strasburg next year or about the same as you were this year?
I mean, you have to roll the injury dice on absolutely everybody. And with Strasburg, they're weighted, you know, against him. But this year, it was kind of my argument with, like, a Tanaka, which didn't pan out as well. But I was on, you know, like, Strasburg as a top five pitcher. The talent is there. It's, you know, all injury stuff. I think, like you said, he has been pretty messiah-y. Masaili, is that a word? And I just really like what he's doing. I don't think we can sit here and say, yes, one person is injury prone over another person, but you can't write anything in stone. And I'm putting my chips on Strasburg when he's on the mound. And yeah, that's all I have to say about that. What do you think, Andrew?
Strasburg's not a guy. I'm a I'm one of those people that tries to stay away from injury risks. When I'm pitching, if I'm getting, try to get a top five starter, I'm going to try to get at a guy that's going to give me 200 innings, 200 strikeouts. But that being said, I mean, for this year moving forward, I would wonder if you can't get Strasburg at a very reasonable price right at your deadline. Because if you've, I mean, he could be the ultimate risk reward guy that's going to push you over the top if you need more pitching. Because you would imagine that the current owner is a little gun shy and probably willing to give him away with, I mean, when you hear forearm strain for a guy that's already had Tommy John, it doesn't bring warm, fuzzy feelings to you. So I wouldn't be a guy I draft next year, but he might be a guy I'm interested in trying to roll the dice on that to try to push me to a championship this year.
Yeah, that's certainly not an opinion anyone can blame you for. You know, it is interesting because I do think Strasburg, if he falls to around the 12 to 15 range next year, you're going to be in a zone of very young pitchers or pitchers who have definitely had some injury problems or some severe performance swings. So you're going to have to pick which poison you like, and Andrew is clearly denoting that the injury history is going to be a major deterrent for the possibilities of him drafting him. So, Andrew, you must be a man after my own heart here. You brought up a Brewer for the program. Why don't you fire away on your second hard-to-gauge player?
Yeah, my second guy is Travis Shaw. He has been, I think, nothing short of a revelation this year. Interesting fact about Travis Shaw is that Baseball Reference says that his nickname is the Mayor of Ding Dong City. I imagine there's probably plenty of signs out for that at Brewers games.
No, but I did know that was his nickname. I'm a bit of a nickname guru. That's one of my favorite things, his nickname. So I was cognizant of that bizarre nickname because I think you're going to let us know that his power history doesn't really say that should be his nickname.
Yeah, when I went back and checked at his minor league history, he never hit more than 16 home runs in the minors. Did some digging against his minor league profiles. I think the most I was able to find was that he's listed as someone with decent power. But he has been somebody that's also been listed as consistently making changes and that has a good approach. When I had looked at players right around the All-Star break, he was among the very few that were, I think, less than 10 guys who were above average in all 5x5 categories. So he was above average in average home runs, RBIs, runs, and steals. You can't get enough of those guys on your roster, but it's hard to be clear as to, is this who he is moving forward? Like, is he really going to be a 30 to 35 home run guy? Is that the baseball and that's going to be kind of everybody?
Yeah, it's not the easiest thing to say. Why don't you go ahead and give us the first retort there, Mr. Evan?
Well, if you wanted to talk about his power, it kind of goes along with the notes that I have, because I wrote that you could basically label my contributions as fun facts about Travis Shaw's home runs. So did you know that he's tied in what ESPN Home Run Tracker categorizes as no doubt home runs at 10 for the season with Stanton and Judge? I didn't know that. I thought that was kind of cool. It's not even, you know, just the move to Miller Park, as 13 of his home runs have come on the road versus 9 at home. And the other thing is that he's doing really well against right-handed pitching. So 18 of his home runs in 286 plate appearances against righties this year. He had 19 home runs in just over 575 samples for his entire career prior. So I really like his batting average splits aren't, you know, home road dependent, and the family stuff that he went through, he came back from that and had since I think it was June 13th was the first day he came back, has the 18th highest OPS since then in the majors. So I love Travis Shaw, and I think this is legit.
Well, when I talk about Travis Shaw, the first thing I need to mention is that my Brewers climbed into first place again today. Did you see that? Because the Cubs lost. So that gives us first place again. So anyway, I like to pretend like that meant that it was a good day for us and we actually did something good. But the point being is that Travis Shaw, I think, is getting a significant boost from the fact that Miller Park is exceptionally good for left-handed power hitters. And I'm also noting that unless you hit the ball directly down the line, that Fenway Park is not a very good park for lefty power hitters. He's 27 years old, and the 7 stolen bases was not exactly a surprise to me or other pundits. He has run a touch everywhere, and the Brewers run a lot. The one thing I really don't like is I don't like the fact that this year he's only played one game at first base. And if you happen to be as big of a Brewers geek as I am, you know that that's because not only do they have Eric Thames, but they've also carried Jesus Aguilar all year. So when Thames has had a day off, it's gone to Aguilar. And VR is not really a great third baseman, but when Shaw needs a break, that usually goes to Hernan Perez. So the multi-eligibility that you're enjoying this year owning Shaw at first and third is not going to be next year. And that's more important than you might think, because third base has gotten so incredibly deep, some would argue even deeper than first base. But I will say this for Travis Shaw, watching him play on a regular basis, I don't think I can recall ever seeing a hitter that stays more in balance throughout his swing. He does very little lunging. He doesn't fall over during a swing. You know, he's the opposite of Carlos Gomez, who is, of course, an ex-Brewer, or, you know, even Keon Broxton, who seems to almost flail at the ball. He hits these majestic home runs that are definitely no doubters, like Evan said, but it comes from this long, smooth swing, almost like Chris Carter, without the exact problems with strikeouts that, of course, are inherent with Chris Carter himself. So I'm really excited about Travis Shaw going forward, and of course the Brewers got him for a steal because they acquired him for Tyler Thornburg, who happened to immediately come down with shoulder issues, thoracic outlet surgery, perhaps, if memory serves me correctly. So 22 home runs at this point. My guess is that he finishes somewhere in the low 30s. I don't think there's any. He's one of those slow and steady players. He's not somebody who generally hits, you know, six or seven in an 8 or 10 game stretch. He basically hits the ball where it's pitched, and that's why, even though a lot of his power has been against right-handed pitching, he's actually hung in there pretty well against lefties, and the Brewers have shown no aversion to having him hit and stay in the lineup against lefties.
Chuck, where do you think you would look to take him next year in a draft?
You know, the just third base is what makes it so difficult. To put a round on it is more difficult, so I'm going to do it. I'm going to go about it, you know, in an inverse fashion. What I'm going to say is I think he's somewhere between, you know, the 13th and the 17th third baseman probably. And so that is going to that's going to put him somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, around 9 or around 10, something in that, you know.
Probably, not to interrupt you, but like maybe something where you saw Jake Lamb or Michael Franco going in drafts coming into this year, maybe?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think Lamb's taken a big step forward and Franco's taken a big step back. And I think he's still going to be a guy that looks kind of like that because, and, you know, there's various reasons for it, but the first half of the season, he looked really good in Boston. Well, then when they tried to bring Pablo Sandoval back and they cut down on his at-bats, I don't know if he was just pressing. So it's going to be one of those things where it's going to be a breakout season that you have to believe in or not believe in. He's definitely not a guy who needs power, you know, to be a playable fantasy commodity. So if the ball tones itself down, I still think he's going to be playable. But I also agree with the analysis that he's probably closer to a 270 to 280 hitter than he is to the kind of hitter that he's been for most of this year. So I wouldn't want to get too excited, but as a fallback option, somebody that you're not counting on as one of your mainstays on your team, I think he's got enough upside for you to be pretty happy with the pick. So It's time to move on to Evan's second player.
Yay. All right. So we kind of posited this as, you know, guys, and maybe it's just how I took it, but guys that were kind of not sure how to feel, you know, coming forward. So I ask you guys, if you were making a playoff run and you needed a little bit of outfield help, how would you feel about acquiring a guy like Justin Upton, who only hit one home run in July, but a lot of his other numbers looked really good? After an 84-33 strikeout to walk ratio in the first 3 months, he was 11 strikeouts to 10 walks in July, so a lot more even. And if the season ended today, his .280 batting average would be the best he's had since his last season in Arizona, which was back in 2012. Doesn't that seem like a long time ago? I guess my questions are, were we too low on Justin Upton in the preseason? Do you think he will be drafted above at the same level, or I don't think he's going to be drafted below where he was last year or this year, next year? And what do you think his value is going forward, given his streakiness and what the state of the Tigers may look like on August 1st? Andrew, I'll throw it to you in whichever way you want to address those.
Sure. So I think he's going to get drafted right around Rays this year. I've been personally big on Justin Upton this year. But whenever I make any note of it on Twitter, people are very quick to shut me down to say, Justin Upton stinks. How can anyone possibly think Justin Upton's any good? So that being said, I mean, earlier this year, I actually wrote a piece on our FWFB site where I chronicled his month-by-month output over the last 3 years to gauge it as a percentage of the entirety of that year to try to show how streaky he was. But this year, he's actually been fairly even. Like, when you look at his numbers, he's flat on pace in the middle to give you his the average is about 10 to 15 points high, but he's going to give you those 30 home runs, those 80 runs, those 80 RBIs. So I think I would be buying for the rest of the year. Things look surprisingly stable for him. So yeah, I mean, I'm in on Justin Upton this year.
Well, I have some longstanding problems with Justin Upton. And a lot of it has to do with the streakiness. And, you know, if you listen to the other podcast I do every week, you'll know that, that people have come to Justin Upton's support while I have been pretty disparaging of him. He is definitely having an excellent year. And he does have a .349 BABIP, which is his highest since 2010. He's got 9 stolen bases. So, I think he had a year in San Diego where he had 19. Couple of years ago or what have you, but the point being is that 9 stolen bases, 4 caught stealings this year. I think a lot of people would be surprised to see that he's still only 29 years old. And I was trying mentally to figure out why he seems so attached right now. And I say that in, you know, opposition to the word detached, because, you know, he was gotten rid of by the Diamondbacks. And they basically announced that he was not the type of player that they wanted, meaning that, that he was a player who, you know, seemed distant, wasn't always considered a great teammate, didn't seem like he had real good focus. These are all things that were pointed at by the Diamondbacks or through baseball media. And when I looked into why he might be so he seems so focused right now, I couldn't really come up with anything. So I thought maybe it had something to do with his contract. But he's actually got, he's got 3 years left on his contract after this at $22 million, $22.125 million for each of the next 3 years after this. So there's no special reason for that. I also think, I've done my share of complaining about the way that the Tigers were built, that they have a lot of contracts that are very difficult to imagine them unloading. You know, they're going through the struggle right now with the Justin Verlander contract, which I still don't think they're going to be able to unload. The Victor Martinez contract was absolutely ridiculous the day that they signed it. You don't take an unathletic DH and throw, you know, $18 million a year at him until, you know, he's in his past his mid-30s. Especially when he was previously a catcher. So that just adds to the wear and tear. And Justin Upton, you know, this contract, they just kept trying to push themselves over the top by getting veterans. And while they're in a better zone with him because he's more athletic and he's only under contract until he's 33 years old, I do think it's important to think that after this year, he's going to be on what's likely to be a much different team, a team with maybe only him and Justin Verlander as the remaining veteran forces within the team. So I think that's going to make things a little more difficult on him as well. So I agree with Andrew. I think right now is a great time to buy in, but I've had Upton on my team for a month or a month and a half where I thought this was finally the year that he was going to carry my team. And then I've had him for the next month and a half where I would do anything not to have to look at his name on my team, because I know he's going to be 0 for 4 or 0 for 5, and I know he's going to strike out in most of his at-bats. It might be a slight exaggeration, but boy, that's definitely how it's felt in some of the years past. And so, you know, I do think the outfield landscape, outfielders, a lot of the veteran outfielders are starting to sort of fall off, the Jose Bautistas and the Ryan Brauns. And I do think you're going to see his value, maybe his value stays the same, but I think maybe the value of some of the veterans in front of them are going to go down. And I think you're going to see, I think you might see him rise up draft boards a little bit through, not so much through the fact that we view him differently, because he's had good stretches before, but because there's other people around him in drafts that we view far lesser than we have in the past. So that is where I am on J-Up. Do you guys remember when it was up, up, and a hay in Atlanta? You've got to remember, right, Evan? Remember up, up, and a hay?
Yeah, I remember the original Upton Brothers, Kate Upton photo shoot, you know, before they recreated that in – was that Detroit? Yeah.
Whoa. I do not remember that. Okay.
BJ played with them in San Diego. Didn't he play in Detroit too?
No.
No. I think it was at Atlanta when it was the two Upton brothers and Hayward at one point.
Yeah. And right. Then they were together for San Diego.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Just one last thing to note on Upton is that he does have an opt-out after this year. So that may drastically change his value if he does opt-out.
You think he's going to get $22 million somewhere? And it's in the next 4 years. I was looking at the contract when you said that. Like, you really think he's going anywhere?
It may be. He may go. Like, if Detroit turns into a dumpster fire more than it already is. Speaking of the team, not the city.
it's. I mean, although that could be said as well.
If he wants to win, he may be willing to take a few like less dollars to go someplace to actually try to win a championship, because it's not coming to Detroit in the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years, most likely, looking at that farm system.
Well, you know, I sounded especially sassy there for a minute, but we were in Detroit last year, downtown Detroit, and it's actually a very nice place to see a game now. And downtown Detroit itself has definitely revived a great deal from their troubles with the auto industry, et cetera. And so I don't want to sound too disparaging against a city I actually like, but
yeah. And I don't either, as a person that grew up like an hour outside of Detroit and have spent quite a bit of time in Detroit and always had a great time. So this is not a knock on the city of Detroit.
No, and the downtown, they're getting a new hockey arena too. Correct. So, I mean, they're doing there's a lot of revitalization and like I said, I had a wonderful time there at the game just last year. So the second person I'm going to talk about is Jason Kipnis. His games played between the years 2012 and 2016 averaged 146 games a year. He's just 30 years old, but during this stretch from the 2012 to 2016, his home runs ranged from 6 1 year to 23 1 year, Most of the time he was in the teens to upper teens. His stolen base range went from 12 stolen bases to 31 stolen bases. So he's one of the most difficult guys to know exactly what you're drafting when you draft him. And I was just wanted to pose the question of how much, you know, with him being at least a few weeks away yet with a hamstring injury, how much value he has going forward, and if this bad season that we have here can kind of be attributed to that really deep World Series run and how heavily he was relied upon to uphold that lineup last year. So why don't we start with you, Andrew? Do you have any hopes for Jason Kipnis going forward, or do you think this is the beginning of the end?
This might be the beginning of the end. His at-bats this year have been dreadfully low, so it's hard to really gauge, but hamstring injury is lingering. He might be a guy that you would look at next year in a draft to see how late you might be able to get him to fill your second base spot. This year, it's going to depend on the cost. I know I checked in the 12-team league that I'm in, and he's available as a free agent, so I know he's somebody I would consider as a free agent if I end up with an injury at second base, but I don't know if I'd actively be trying to acquire him moving forward.
Yeah, and like I said, I like nicknames, and of course his nickname is Dirtbag, which is kind of a fun nickname. That's probably a nickname that maybe Evan had at some point in his life. So, Evan, what are your thoughts? Do you think Jason Kipnis bounces back either late this year or early next year?
No, my nickname was never Dirtbag, but they did call me Porkchop as a kindergartner, and that may explain a lot of things about my personality. As far as Jason Kipnis, I think a lot of people are hanging on to name value. I'm kind of out on Kipnis. I don't really care what the draft price is next year. If you want to go ahead and attribute it to the playoff run last year, go ahead. I'll attribute it to the fact that he came into the season not healthy and probably has not been. And he's a guy that even though you look at, you know, he's amassed, what, over 640 plate appearances, the four out of the past 5 years. It's just always something with this guy. And I don't know if, you know, speed going forward, if you want to take a bet on his batting average, which has kind of been all over the place, it's at a 232 right now. I'm just out on Kipnis, and if somebody wants to beat me with Jason Kipnis in their lineup, congratulations, but it's not a road I'm going down.
Well, I guess there is at least the possibility that maybe you'd be able to get him as a middle infielder next year instead of having him as your second baseman, especially if you're in a 12-team league.
I'd rather draft Marwin Gonzalez.
Ooh, I don't know that I would go that far. I do understand, like I said, I do understand this sort of roller coaster that he's been on statistically. So and the fact that it's hard to rely on him for anything, really. You don't know if you're getting speed. You don't know if you're getting power. The one thing I would say on his behalf is that when he is healthy, they do seem to be very prone to batting him right in the middle of what turns out to be a fairly strong lineup more often than not. So that I will say for him, and I have more hope for a pulse going forward than Evan, who is taking a player that he basically disparaged earlier in the podcast in Marwin Gonzalez over him going forward. I'll take Jason Kipnis next year over Gonzalez. How about you, Andrew? Kipnis or Gonzalez next year?
I would go Gonzalez. And the one we're really tips the scales here for me is actually the multi-position eligibility that you referenced earlier, Chuck. Because I know at least with Gonzalez, if somebody gets hurt, I can move him into, you know, three or four different places. If I've got Kipnis sitting around, I can only play him in at best middle infield and second base.
Well, that's an understandable aspect of it. I've been a sucker. I was a sucker this year. I have him on one team of mine that turned into an absolute dumpster fire. Of course, I can blame Trevor Story and the no-power from Justin Turner and about 30 other things on that team. But definitely Kipnis did not help me at all either. So, well, Andrew, let's move from Jason Kipnis to another middle infielder, and actually a middle infielder who is a teammate of Jason Kipnis. And why don't you tell us about the other player you find hard to gauge going forward?
Yeah, Francisco Lindor's been he's been a popular name for people to buy at the deadline this year. When I went and did some deeper research on him, it's really easy to understand why. His numbers this year create a bit of an enigma for me. His hard contact's up, soft contact's down, his ISO's up. Everything that you look for in why his numbers should be great are all there, except for the numbers themselves. I have to believe that all of those numbers probably leave a trend that there's going to be an elongated hot streak moving forward. This is baseball and that's wishful thinking. So anything can happen, but I'd be willing to buy into Francisco Lindor moving forward. But the numbers right now his production numbers don't match the underlying metrics.
Well, this is an easy one for me to throw over to Evan, because Evan's original list that he gave me also had Francisco Lindor on it. So you guys, I will take the reasons that you find him difficult to gauge, and then I'll tell you why I think I got him pegged. So, Evan, how do you feel about Francisco Lindor now?
Yeah, and I mean, I was watching the Indians game on Sunday, and the broadcast booth was talking a lot about, you know, the walk-off home run, and he was one of the youngest guys to hit a walk-off home run, and that – Sunday game, he had a couple infield hits. So the point being in all that is that he does a lot in big spots that may not necessarily show up in the box score, but since we're, you know, fantasy players, that's what we care about. And there's two areas that he struggled in so far this year, which is the speed and the batting average. So regarding the batting average, he's being stifled by shifts to the tune of a .245 batting average against, compared to a .365 he hit against them last year. And he's having some struggles with righties that I think are very heavily BABIP influenced. And I don't really see any worries in regards to like his strikeout numbers, his walk numbers, anything in those splits. As far as the speed, it's kind of hard to steal when he's essentially at the same number of home runs and doubles as he was for his totals last year. So I think that may have something to do with it. And when you look at his player rater numbers, so he's 14th overall, and he's barely positive in steals and average. But if he was one standard deviation better in both of them, he would be the sixth shortstop on the player rater. So while he's not looking great there, I think his numbers are still good enough to play, and I think he's in this weird spot where the numbers aren't adding up. And if somebody's looking at that and wants to sell, I'm buying.
Well, I certainly think that you guys are along the consensus, because I've also heard a lot of anything but panic about what's gone on with Francisco Lindor. And I'm not panicking about him either. I guess this reaffirms what I was afraid of for most of the young shortstops. And he is still just 23 years old, so I do think he's got many productive seasons in front of him. You know, his .271 BABIP is 53 points down from last year. And in my of note column, et cetera, I've often pointed to the fact that I think shortstops are the most likely position players to not grow in a linear fashion, meaning that I expect a lot of fits and spasms within the development, and I've seen a lot of examples of this. Obviously, Trevor Story is a great example this year. He's finally sort of starting to come out of it, but he was somebody who was taken by, the middle of the third round or early in the fourth in almost any size draft last year, and he's been absolutely toxic. He's been horrible. Jonathan Villar, just 24 years old. His troubles have been well chronicled. He's in danger of not playing very much from here on out the rest of the season, but he's still a guy that I would be willing to invest in next year. Carlos Correa is a guy who probably got overdrafted last year in 2016, and this year it certainly looks like he has been pretty good, but now he's out for the season. And I'm even going to include Gene Segura, who, of course, had the personal tragedy in his history, but he also had – you know, his all-star appearance with the Brewers, followed by a year where he looked completely clueless at the plate overall. And then this year, of course, Segura, again, is kind of confusing because his batting average is saving him, but his power is way down. Of course, some of that can be attributed for the move from Arizona to Seattle. But, you know, I'm expecting random outputs from all these young shortstops. And so I don't really disagree. I do think there's going to be, you know, very good years to own Francisco Lindor ahead. I just, until he gets to that age 26 or 27 season, I'm just not going to pay up like all the shortstops were paid up for this year. I'm just, you know, I think – I've always had Carlos Correa as a notch above these type of players. And remember, Francisco Lindor is a guy, you know, these shortstops get to the bigs because of their gloves, okay? And then you add in the fact that they're so young that they're going to mature plate discipline-wise in a number of different ways. I just posted today talking about how Orlando Arcia is a guy that everyone thought was not going to hit much because he looked so bad last year at the plate. Well, he's been a really good value for where he was drafted this year, or if you picked him up for his good stretches of the season, and he looks like he's going to be a competent offensive player. And I dealt with Evan's overexcitement about Dansby Swanson, who basically in most situations probably would have been sent down a couple different times this year. I don't have an issue that Dansby Swanson is going to have good years and he's going to be a very solid major league player. I think investing early picks in shortstops that, you know, that don't have a pedigree or aren't thought that they're going to be really, really upper echelon hitters. I don't struggle with Seager and Correa, but the rest of the shortstops are guys that, I would rather take in the fifth or sixth round than in the second or third going forward. And if the Fearless Prediction show that I did with Justin and Darius, I remember very clearly stating that most of these young shortstops that we were jumping all over were not going to come anywhere as close to reaching their ADPs in their actual value. And unfortunately, that has come to fruition because I think they're all good players and I think they're all going to have good stretches. But I just don't want to pay for knowing exactly when things are going to go good and when they're not going to go good. So that is sort of where I'm at with Francisco Lindor. I won't blame anybody for drafting him, but I'm not going to be jumping the gun on drafting him going forward. And I'd be a little concerned about even trading for him, although he is a significant amount better than what you could get on the waiver wire. So if you're getting any form of a discount, I'm not going to blame you for using him as a fill-in at your shortstop position. But I don't know what you can count on. You're sort of shooting for the moon because he's got all different kinds of potential outcomes as far as I am concerned. Okay, now let's move on to Evan's third player. And that is the used-to-be multi-position eligibility, Matt Carpenter. What are your thoughts on Matt Carpenter?
I mean, I don't own a ton of Carpenter this year. I mean, he's a guy I was interested in, but he's 214 on the player radar right now, and I don't think that's what his owners were looking for when they drafted him, you know, probably around like the 50 or 60th overall pick this year. If you're in an OBP league, that's, you know, obviously a little bit better. Can we get an OBP player rater for Christ's sakes? Come on. Like, it's the one thing I want out of life. Well, there's a few other things. But 248 batting average. He's never hit below 270 for a season. And he's got some weird shift numbers going on. He's been a better hitter against the shift. But right now against non-shifted defense, he's hitting 220 this year. So that's probably due to come up. And the Cardinals offense has kind of picked things up lately over the past month. I think they're top five in runs scored over in baseball over the last 30 days. So I don't know if you guys think you could catch a disgruntled Carpenter owner, or, you know, like if you want to project into next year, Chuck, I'm sure you took a look at his eligibility or have been charting it somewhere on the wall in your house. Tell me where you're at with Matt Carpenter this year going forward and all around.
Well, I was a little bit surprised. I actually was trying to own some pieces of Matt Carpenter going into the year for the exact reasons that you state, that he was first and third base eligible. And I couldn't acquire him because people were jumping on him before I thought he was really due. I remember in the staff league, I took Daniel Murphy after Matt Carpenter went. And I was in a form of disbelief because I do like Matt Carpenter generally speaking. He's had some great games against the Brewers for sure, and he always looks very good in division games seemingly. But this year, the bottom has really sort of fallen off. I mean, last year there was the back. Everyone said his back was hurt, and that's why he fell off, and he was on pace to have his best year ever, et cetera, and so forth. Well, I'm getting to the point now where I've grown a little weary on it. If somebody's going to catch lightning in a bottle on Matt Carpenter against me, so be it. But it seems like there's always a little something. There's a ding against him that keeps him from being a truly elite player almost every year. And so I'm not as high on Matt Carpenter as you might think going forward. One of the things I really am concerned about is St. Louis seems to be a lesser version of San Francisco in so much as they don't seem to be overly investing in their offense these days. You know, they've gotten a pretty nice boost from Jorko overall, but, you know, basically, you know, since they lost Holiday, the only thing they brought in was Dexter Fowler, and that looked terrible. And unlike Matt Thompson, I did not like that pickup from the second I heard about it. So I'm pretty low on the St. Louis offense going forward. I also think that the bottom is going to fall out on Yadier Molina. I know they have some that prospect they just called up, so they have some hopes for a backup. But Yadier Molina in that town is somebody that they're going to stick to. You know, he's going to have to bat .140 for about 2.5 years before they get rid of him. And so I have some real concerns. Piscotty's had a really bad year, a down year. They've gotten really lucky that Tommy Pham has appeared out of nowhere. That's something I wouldn't bet on going forward, that Tommy Pham is going to save the franchise offensively. I would bet against that fairly strongly. And so I don't like his situation, and he's been just streaky enough that I'm pretty much out on Matt Carpenter versus where I think he's going to go because of name recognition. This is not the Cardinals of a few years ago anymore. This is a much different team. I mean, this isn't Holiday and Pujols in the middle of the lineup, you know, when they were in their prime. This is a lot of smoke and mirrors to me offensively. How about you, Andrew? How do you feel about Matt Carpenter?
Yeah, moving forward into next year, I mean, if you think of Matt Carpenter as first base eligible only, that's not a great thought as to, you know, how he stacks up against other players at first base when you look at his production outside of probably anything but an OBP league. It was interesting to see that even with his walks have actually been up enough that it's kept his on-base percentage in the same place it was last year in spite of the significant dip in his average. I wonder if Matt Carpenter is actually not the consider him kind of the anti-Yonder Alonso, where the increase in his launch angle has actually created a problem for him as to instead of creating a bunch of home runs, as it looks like over the last couple of years, he's shifted his launch angle as Cardinals have started to expect more and more power from him. Largely though, yeah, I'm out on Carpenter unless I'm getting him at an extreme discount moving forward.
And I could very well, I could be wrong. Maybe there will be a significant discount on him, and he's somebody that you can pick up if you wait on first base next year. name recognition sort of has carried him to this point, because of course he was a very steady contributor when he was their leadoff hitter for some of their World Series runs. But you know, I'm sort of in the same boat as Andrew. If I'm not getting a significant discount, you know, it's odd because everybody broke out at first base this year, and the concept that you could like, you know, you could rather take a gamble on Yonder Alonso than Matt Carpenter is a foreign concept to our skulls right now. But it's also a matter of, like, if it's a position that you're going to wait on, and there's a whole group of those kind of first basemen that have come out of nowhere, then would you rather wait and take one of those guys and fill other needs? You know, would you be willing to take a gamble on a Logan Morrison or a Justin Smoke or, you know, all these first basemen? They're all doing it, for God's sakes, is what it seems like. And, of course, they're not. But the point being is that there's going to be some added depth beyond where I think Matt Carpenter is going to go. And if I'm willing to take a gamble on what that St. Louis offense represents now versus some of those other offenses, is really hard. It's hard for me to tell going forward. So you know, in this case, I'm gonna let Evan retort us, because we sort of ragged on Matt Carpenter quite a bit. So go ahead and tell us if you agree or disagree with our thoughts.
I mean, I don't really, like I said, I gave pretty much all of my Carpenter thoughts kind of in one little bow. I don't think there's a lot of fantasticness coming forward, and I do think his name recognition is going to carry him. I mean, he threw out Morrison and Smoke. I would say I'd probably take Smoke out of the three of them. I'd say Carpenter's in the middle, and I'm just not really a Lomo guy. But, I mean, do you think Carpenter gets drafted outside the top 100 next year?
Boy, he will be by me if I draft him, I can tell you that.
Well, yeah, I would draft him out there too.
My guts tell me that he's outside of a top 100 player. I mean, the one thing that he had inconsistent power before, and now with this power surge and the fact that he's not really he's not going to make up for it in counting numbers necessarily with that team without a major rebound from a number of players. I mean, how many years did we hold out for Colton Wong? Is that done now? Are we done with Colton Wong, for the love of Jesus? Do I have to go through another year of Colton Wong as a sleeper? Because I pray to God I don't, but I'm just sick of it. People thought he was a Cardinal, so all of a sudden he was going to turn into Ricky Henderson, for the love of Christ. Anyway, okay, I'm done. Anyway, the point being is that I'm struggling to see where both the support around him and how this new environment helps Matt Carpenter's value, or Chris Carpenter's value for that matter. That's a different issue. Anyway, Andrew, you in agreement with me? You think he's outside the top 100 next year?
I definitely do. I mean, will I be shocked if I see him drafted in the top 100? No, because of the name value. I mean, typically the Cardinals are a bit of an overvalued franchise when we think about their players. But I think I think if you take that dividing line of kind of the average Joe draft, and then if you maybe keep an eye on where he goes in, you know, tout or a draft like that, I'd be really shocked if he went in the top 100 of a Tout Wars draft or an industry professionals draft. I wouldn't definitely not be surprised in if ADP pushed him up because of average people just doing mock drafts getting ready.
Yeah, is he Alan Craig 2.0?
Boy, I don't think that's very fair. His career already has been significantly better than Alan Craig's, and I don't think he's an unplayable player. Like, Alan Craig turned into someone that you had a hard time finding a roster spot for occasional pinch hitting duty. And I don't think that the bottom is going to drop out that fast for Carpenter. So that would be my take on it for sure. Well, that was a lot of Matt Carpenter talk, but again, he's a player that the opinions on him are definitely wide array of opinions. And on top of it, he's someone that the opinions have definitely changed a lot this year. My third player that I want to talk about is, I'm really excited about this actually, is JT Realmuto. Just 26 years old, We all wish he didn't play in Miami because it's such a hard place to hit home runs for. One of the things I'm curious about is I'm wondering if there's any chance at all that he plays a significant amount of first base, being a right-handed hitter. You know, he could spell. He could spell the first baseman we didn't speak about in Miami. He could spell him, Justin Bour, a game or two at first base and maybe get some extra eligibility moving forward and get us extra at-bats that we'd like. But the trends for a 26-year-old hitter are really wonderful with Real Muto. His strikeouts are down 3%. His walks are up 2.1%. While his pull percentage is up almost 5%, 4.5%, and his batting average went up from 303 to 305. Now, he's on pace for 15-plus home runs with close to double-digit stolen bases. You know, I'm going to reach for the sky here and wonder if there's not a case that you could make that JT Realmuto, if you look at both the trends and you add in the fact that he's going to give you something in stolen bases that you don't usually get from catchers, I'm going to ask if JT Realmuto could be the second catcher off the board next year. So what do you think about that? It's sort of crazy, foolish talk, Evan.
I think it's crazy. I'm not laughing and smiling because of how crazy you are. I'm laughing and smiling because you're the only guy that says Realmuto instead of Muto, like the mute button and not the sound a cow would make. But I don't know. Maybe that's just me. It makes me smile. That's one of the many things I love about you, Chuck. You know, the speed will kind of lead to maybe not this, you know, 7-triple season that he had 2015 that, like, nobody talks about, even though speed is kind of his calling card at catcher. But I do think the things he's hindered by are the ballpark. You talk about him, like, playing first base and spelling Justin Bour, who actually I was looking at his splits against lefties real quick because that's where a lot of people thought that the time for JT was going to come at first. And Bohr's been really good against left-handers this year. He's hitting 328 with 6 home runs off them. He'd never hit a home run off lefties in the bigs before this year. So I think he's kind of there to stay. I think Realmuto – I almost said it, damn it. Realmuto's production will be pretty similar to what we've seen, even though his, you know, his home run numbers are basically career highs already this year. I mean, I just don't really see him as a 20 home run guy. And I think the Marlins as an offense are kind of average to below. So I don't buy him as the second catcher overall. Andrew may tell me that, you know, I'm wrong and you're right, Chuck.
I think the only thing I can tell you that you're wrong about it is it's definitely Realmuto.
Is it really?
I have no idea if it is or not. I'm just not, but that's how I've always been pronouncing it in my head.
I want to say I looked up. I got that from the pronunciation, and you know, the moo would be the sound of a cow, and mu. I'm pretty sure mu is a Greek letter, even though I was never in a fraternity. So there you go.
I think Chuck is also cow biased, living in Wisconsin, but that's beside the point.
One too many spotted cows to the brain.
My wife is very thin. Thank you. Anyway, that's not actually the point. But, Andrew, how do you feel about Realmuto going forward?
I would say there is zero chance that he'd be the second catcher off the board next year. I can't imagine a world where he's going ahead of both Gary Sanchez and Buster Posey. But I would also wonder with his long-term perspective as being a catcher, he kind of almost seems to fit that profile of Joe Mauer Light, where he hits too well and he runs too well to keep him at catcher forever. So while first base might not be the right fit, I'd wonder if maybe he might fit in at second as a crazy thought to throw out there, given that the Marlins don't have anything in that spot. But when I look at him statistically, I mean, he plays a ton. He's already at 82 games. Walks are up, but they're still not great. His ISO is way up from last year, up like 50 points. His hard contact is up, soft contact's down. Very interestingly, his infield fly ball rate is down from, it was 16% last year, 5% this year. But that was a very strange trend with him over like 4 years. He jumps from 16 to like 5 or 6%, then back up to 16, then back down to 5%. And it seems to make a pretty significant, when you look at his batted ball profile, it seems to really weigh heavily on his production and how he does year over year so far.
Well, I'll say this for Real Muto. I'll say that, you know, he's trending the right direction and he's on the way up, which obviously you can say about Gary Sanchez. And while I do think it would be kind of crazy to take him over Posey at this point, I definitely think that Real Muto looks like, yeah, I think it's a more difficult question. And let's put it to you guys this way. Would you rather have Real Muto next year or Salvador Perez? How about you, Evan?
Man, and I've been kind of an anti-Perez guy. I think I would probably go with him, even though I'm expecting him to get hurt at any given point in time with all the mileage the Royals have put on him.
I think from what I hear so far, we need to be in drafts together, you guys, because I would love to have Real Muto as my catcher next year, and you guys don't seem nearly as excited as me. How about you, Real Muto or Sal Perez next year?
I'm on Real Muto. I mean, I'm as high on him. I think I'm actually a lot higher on him than you think. I'm just not taking him at two. He's probably my third catcher on the board, but I'm also a guy that's like, unless I'm getting him, like, I drafted catcher in much of my drafts this year in like 16 or later, because I wasn't going to pay up for it. But yeah, I'm taking Real Muto over Sal Perez because I feel like there's going to come this moment where Sal Perez is going to stand up from the dish and you're actually going to see his like kneecaps disintegrate and just lay there on top of the home plate. So
yeah, that's somewhere between exceptionally morbid and almost like a sci-fi sort of thing, which was actually kind of amusing to hear. I do think people are obviously stunned by the year that Sal Perez has had. I mean, he's actually carried that offense for various stretches of time. You know, the wear and tear we've been expecting from the fact that, you know, Ned Yost has ridden him like a rented mule over their World Series runs, et cetera, doesn't seem to be catching up to him the way that we would think it would. But I would strongly prefer Real Muto over Perez next year. And me and Andrew sound like we're in different spots right now, because the gentleman who, Rob Silver, who won the main event last year for NFBC, made a strong point in our podcast interview of him of mentioning that if you don't get anybody at catcher in two catcher leagues, especially, that then you're really punting two positions where other people could be getting stuff from. And I wonder how much depth there could be, since I think catcher, and I actually talked about it in my Of Note column, which came out today, that I wonder how much depth there's going to be at catcher going forward, because I don't see a lot of upside in the catchers that are outside of the top 10 now. I don't see big jumps coming from the Cameron Rupps of the world or the Martin Maldonados, you know, and then you have the catching splits going on in Milwaukee and in Houston right now, et cetera. So there's something I think to be said for trying to get a strong catcher more so than there's been in the past. I got away with, you know, an all-star season out of the Twins catcher now, Jason Castro, et cetera. You know, the Sandy Leon miracle saved me in the second half of one season, et cetera. But I'm less prone to do that now. After much consideration, I definitely would like to get some production out of my catchers going forward, because I don't want to give up two positions of my offense. So that's one of the reasons that I'm hoping that there's a lot of people out there that think as little of Real Muto going forward as Evan does, because this is a rare situation where we kind of disagree. I think Real Muto has a very good chance to be a 20 home run a year kind of catcher as he gets closer to 30. And I much prefer the Marlins offense going forward to say the Cardinals, which we spoke about earlier, or, you know, the Padres or the Braves, et cetera, and so forth, that I don't think offer the same amount of depth. I mean, I don't think you have to worry about Giancarlo Stanton getting traded when he's owed, you know, a quarter of most of the franchise values in Major League Baseball. which I'm sure is also an exaggeration, but not as big an exaggeration as it should be. So at least Stanton, nobody talks about this. Stanton is finally healthy and is on a hot streak right now. Homered again tonight. So
two homers tonight. He's back tied to the lead.
Yeah, I mean, we've all known that he's got massive power if it all goes well. But if he were to do something ridiculous like hit, over 60 home runs in that ballpark, that would be a feat that we would have a hard time realizing exactly how mammoth it is. But you know, I also think they're getting a lot out of Marcelo Ozuna. And although they like to retool in Miami, I don't think, at least they're not usually giving up. I know they take a lot of hits for their management style, and I don't blame people for, the sort of dumping that they've done in the past. One thing we didn't mention is you said that the Marlins don't have anything at second. Well, I don't think D. Gordon could play short anymore. And I do think they have D. Gordon there. And for some reason, they seem very devoted to Martin Prado at third, which is another place that I think Real Muto could move. I'm not exactly sure why they're so devoted to Prado. I do think Prado is a better real-life player than he is a fantasy player. But
it's probably a similar reason to why my brain lapsed on the existence of D. Gordon.
Yeah, I mean, D. Gordon, D. Gordon, you always get the running from him. But they seem very devoted to Gordon as well, because I know they signed him to an extension not too long ago. So, anyway, I think we covered nine pretty interesting players that we haven't really gone too far in depth in recent memory. And I liked our discussion a great deal. Why don't you reiterate, Evan, what you're working on? Tell us a little bit about your schedule for your football podcasts, and if you know when you're going to be on for those, et cetera, and go from there. Make sure you don't forget your Twitter handle so people can yell at you on Twitter, even though you claim you don't check it as much.
I really don't, actually. So it's at FWFB. You can find me, football podcast. We got to figure out when we're doing this stupid thing, but there's going to be a lot coming down the pipe. I may actually start writing again. So look forward to that and run for the hills. Until then, try and annoy me on the Twitter machine. Check me out here. Give us a rate and review. And that's all. Ben, come back. We miss you.
And Andrew, why don't you keep us posted on everything that you're working on and reiterate your Twitter feed for us?
Sure. Writing baseball articles every other week right now. Going to start having probably either divisional previews or team previews for hockey in the next few weeks. And you can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. And if you need somebody to yell at, feel free to use Twitter to do so.
All right, and I don't know that I actually announced myself. I just assumed by now you poor suffering souls out there knew who I was and the annoyance that I could be. But I am I'm Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. And I check my Twitter feed every day. Took some recent questions about Brad Boxberger and the fact that I knew that his rehab was going well, and of course I think he's gotten pounded on ever since I told him that that things looked like they were pretty solid for Boxberger. So I apologize if that person is listening out there. So anyway I'm doing the Of Note column every week. Last week I got done too late on Friday, so I had to put it out on Monday, so we'll have two out there for you this week. I love doing these podcasts. I love talking to smart people about baseball, and Evan and Andrew certainly count, are in that column, to say the least. So for this week's mid-week version of Friends with Fantasy Benefits, this has been Chuck Anderson, Andrew Dewhurst, and Evan Peterson, and we will welcome Ben Brennis back next week. Thanks so much for tagging in and helping us out, Andrew. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, don't forget to nominate us for the Podcast Awards on podcastawards.com, and we'll keep putting out real solid content for you all year round. Thanks a lot. Bye now.